This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, so fired up for today. I should say, first of all, hosts, but also realtors with Oakland Realty in downtown Vancouver. Today, Andrew Liss. He's the Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors, formerly the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver. And we are 1 week after the first, after Q1, first quarter in the market. And Andrew is here to give the in-depth recap.
Yeah, this is an exciting conversation. I think Andrew's been on at least twice in the past. Such a thoughtful guy, deep in the data. This is what he lives and breathes. So it's great having Andrew on to break down the first quarter of 2025 for us. But before we cut to that, Adam, we did run a timeless repeat, Peter Leung, global investor last week. And we did so because, and I'm not questioning your patriotism here, you went to the United States over the holidays.
Yeah, my elbows were up.
Your elbows were up the whole time. Okay, good.
My elbows were up on the plane. My wife was a little upset about that. I was sharpening my elbows. You know what? We booked a trip. We booked a trip before all the craziness happened. And, you know, some more patriotic.
No one can fault you for that.
Some more patriotic people might have canceled, but Hawaii is still Hawaii. So, no, it was a great trip. I'm back. I'm rested. And, you know, I mean, here's a scary thought about canceling that trip is two kids with no childcare stuck at home when I think we had like...
break.
Well, we had like 2 weeks of rain here too. Like it was just nonstop. So, yeah. So it was
spring
good to kind of escape
into
for
an
a
absolute,
bit.
An absolute nightmare, a hellscape.
Yeah, I don't know if I told you this, but this was kind of the highlight of the trip. Like, so we're not the type of people that ever, you know, win door prizes or anything like that. Like we're not very lucky in that way, I would say. And right. My wife was renting a car in Waikiki because we were going to go to we spent some days on the North Shore and Kailua Beach. And anyways, long story short, she saved $400 by getting what they call the secret car. And she didn't really, like, I would have just been like, okay, give me the Corolla or whatever, right? Cheapest car you got. Last time we traveled in Costa Rica.
Just so I understand, the secret car is cheaper because it could be
anything
from like a Pinto to anything. Yeah. Any year,
well,
any size.
Any year, any size. So like it could have been like a motorcycle with a side cart. Like it could have been anything. I was expecting...
Risky endeavor with two kids.
I know. But $400 savings. You believe that?
Yeah.
It's a challenging market out there. So here's the thing. We were fully expecting like a 1983 Hyundai Pony. Like, that's like what I was expecting. Like, they're like
secretly
the secret car. Yeah. So anyways, we lined up. We get to the front of the counter, super busy where we were getting the car. And the guy's like, I said to him, well, what's the secret car? And he's like, I don't even know. He's like, they don't even show me. And he's like, so.
Do you have to take it or can they show it to you? And you go, actually, no.
No. You have to take it or you've already paid for it. It's a total gamble. You have no idea.
Oh, my God.
Anyways.
I don't know if I'd roll those dice.
Yeah. I wouldn't have
okay,
either.
$400.
I did, this is okay, 100%, 100% my wife. So anyways, long story short, turns out it's the Mercedes GLE. I don't know. I don't even know that. It's like north of $100,000, the vehicle. But it's like fully 7-seater SUV, Mercedes, like wild car. Anyways, no fun to drive. Had it for the whole time I was there, and saved $400 on the Corolla.
Cheaper than the Corolla. Wow.
Cheaper than the Corolla. So that was one of the highlights. Never happens to me, but anyways, one of the funny stories.
Fantastic. We also, before we get to Andrew Liss, we are sponsored by our real estate
secret car at Avis Realty. No, we're not. No, we are of course sponsored by ourselves, Galena Real Estate. This week, Matt, we have an amazing new listing that we're going to get to.
Oh, wait a second. I got a question for you.
Yeah, but first, the Remains Nameless Quiz.
The Remains Nameless Quiz. This week, I struggled. I had a number of questions, and you know what? I'll give this one a whirl. How much of the landmass, Adam, of British Columbia is private property? Mm. So not Crown land, provincial land, but able to be bought and sold by individuals. How much of the territory of the province of British Columbia? But before you give your answer, Adam, before you give your answer,
I'm scared to even answer this. I feel like I'm going to be way off.
No, Google. This is the point. I just want to.
I'm not going to Google it. Come on, I'm not going to ruin the. Let me just pull up ChatGPT here.
Just want to test your knowledge. But before we get to that, Adam, tell us about, this is the post spring break listing boom. We got a hot one.
Today. I love this house. This is 1121 Kiefer Street. This is like prime Strathcona, East Vancouver, super community rich, trendy area. And this house, so it's on what's almost a standard lot in Strathcona. They're 25 footers, so 25 by 122. So you get a 3,050 square foot lot, fully renovated house, 2,200 square feet. It was renovated in 2017. 5-bed, 3-bath family home with, get this, Matt, a bonus detached studio loft space with a bathroom. So this is a 411 square foot separate plumbed detached studio space, which is really cool. So you get the house, you get the studio space, and it's in a fantastic location. Tons of updates. So mechanically sound, contemporary finishes, really beautiful. Right by, and a lot of our listeners will know, Assembly, built by Fabric, by Jordan McDonald and Fabric. So this is right down the street from Assembly, like a stone's throw. So you get, you know, you benefit from all the breweries, Michelin star restaurants, McLean Park. You walk to Commercial Drive. So it's all right there. And the list price is $1,919,900.
And so head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where you can see that listing and all the rest of our featured listings. And while you're there, click sell with us and you can download the sold plan. This is our most downloaded PDF document that's downloaded on demand that we've ever released. So that's all over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But Adam, maybe we should cut back to this daunting trivia question. I thought this was an easy one.
I mean, it's so tricky because I guess there's... it's a big province. Crown land. There's a lot of... I'm just guessing. I don't know. I'm guessing it's below 50%. I'm going to go
30%. 30%. That's your final answer.
Yeah. And I have no idea. I really have no idea. I'd have
The answer, Adam, I'm pretty sure no one has an idea or very few people. The answer is 5%.
Oh my God.
5% of the province can be bought and sold as freehold property.
That's wild.
94% is owned by, controlled by the province, and 1% is owned federally or controlled federally. I don't know what.
Only 1%?
Only 1%. It's a condo, right?
It's the railway that runs through my living room. It's those damn CN rails. No, but it's what do you know what the 1% is?
No, I have no idea. Well, I was thinking it's that, you know, there are those, there's some leasehold land downtown that's Crown. and it, but other than that, I'm not sure. Yeah, anyway, most of it's controlled by the province. Only 5% is freehold property.
Holy.
Yeah, so an interesting...
If that doesn't make you want to buy land, there's only 5%. Exactly.
There's a shortage, come right? On.
Exactly. All right, Matt. Well, without further ado, let's cut to this conversation with Andrew Liss. He's the Director of Economics and Data Analytics for Greater Vancouver Realtors, past guest, fan favorite. I love having Andrew on the program and he's such a great guy. So this is going to be a good one.
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior one to three-bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenehaus. Or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is the time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life. Okay, so we're here with Andrew Liss. He's the Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors, or GVR. Thanks for taking the time, and how you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing really well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is, I think, your third time? Third or fourth time? Anyway, third past or fourth, guest fan favorite for sure.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's good to hear. I'm glad people enjoy what I'm saying. That's I haven't tanked your show yet. That's good.
Well, but maybe for people who haven't heard you on the show, Andrew, or are not familiar, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm the Director of Economics and Data Analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors, formerly the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver. So my job there is kind of twofold. I do a lot of like media and stuff like this, where I'm talking about the market and being an economist, putting my economist hat on and talking about, you know, what's going on with the Vancouver market, or even more broadly, you know, I tend to look at a lot of things from the macro lens of stuff, not just in Canada, but British Columbia as well. So try to bring that all home to how it impacts the market around Vancouver. The other part of the job there is involved in around like our data and building out some analytics. So I built this little website that we have that people can go to and check out, you know, whatever research I'm working on. You can check it out at economics.gvrealtors.ca. And it's, you'll find a blog there of like random, you know, articles that I'll write about what's going on in the market at some particular time. But you also find things like ways to keep track of the market. We've created some products there that you can access for free. There's some downloadable data and some other information that you know, we're trying to provide to the public to be, you know, more open and transparent and improve professionalism in the industry. So kind of a multifold thing there, and leading a little group internally of trying to improve some of our products and statistics, which I will admit is a bit of a slower process than I had hoped, but we are chugging away every single day. And I think in the coming year or so, people are going to start seeing a lot more you know, new stuff coming out from that end. So pretty excited about what we have down in the tank, but that's a little bit about what I do.
Excellent. Well, maybe, Andrew, part of the reason that we brought you on today is we wanted to circle back. We're coming just really at the end of Q1 here in 2025. And obviously, it's been an interesting start to the year. But in thinking about the first quarter of 2025, what's your big picture assessment, and where does the Vancouver market stand right now?
Yeah, so we did our forecast in January, coming off, you know, pretty strong fourth quarter of 2024. We had actually really improved sales in the last couple months of 2024. Things were looking pretty rosy. I wrote a piece about how, you know, it seemed like interest rates were finally, or lower interest rates, I should say, or have finally, you know, had an impact on the market. And the impact that we typically expect to see as economists, you tend to see sales pick up. So that seemed like that was happening. Then January came and we wrote a forecast, you know, with this at our backs and looking forward into, you know, 2025, and things seemed pretty rosy. So our forecast called for growth of about like 10, 12% on sales or something for the year, and some price growth of about 3 or 4%. So it's not exactly a wild forecast of the future, but it's certainly calling for upward momentum. Thing that's funny about it is so far the first quarter hasn't really been living up to the expectations of that forecast. Now, a lot can happen throughout the course of the year. We've seen this situation before where the year starts out a little bit slower on sales and things really pick up in the spring, summer, not just from the seasonal perspective, but like above seasonal norms and things like that. We've had a couple of years where this has happened before. So I'm not like too concerned, but you know, it definitely isn't, the sales are not coming in as strong as I would have anticipated by this point in the year. It's a bit weird given where rates are at. You know, I think like people are now, like they've kind of settled in a band where, you know, I think people have gotten used to the idea of like maybe a fixed with a 5 or a little bit lower in front of it or something, you know, and a variable with maybe, you can maybe get a bit lower than that. I think we're at like 4.3 or something, maybe a little lower. So, you know, those aren't wildly high interest rates. And there's a lot of inventory on the market right now, which is super good for buyers. I mean, even for sellers as well, to some degree, because it gives you choice. One of the weird things about, you know, Vancouver's market that we've had for years and years and years is just these like chronically low inventory levels that make transacting difficult for everybody, for buyers and sellers. Buyers end up having to, you know, compete for property. Sellers are sort of like, well, where am I even going to move to kind of problem? Well, now you got all kinds of choices of where to move, but the buyers aren't really showing up in the numbers that we've expected. So yeah, it's a bit of a weird start to 2025 so far.
So Andrew, I think everyone's kind of, I feel like we had a forecast show in late 2024 and we were kind of feeling the same way, optimistic about the market. Most people are going to assume tariffs as kind of a singular cause here. Is that, like, thinking about a headline in 2025 so far, is that your analysis of where we're at? Is that the full, you know, reason, period, stop, full stop?
Yeah, so I'm skeptical of the tariff argument. I wrote a little piece on the economics blog. People can check it out. It's called Uncertain Uncertainty. Did it recently. And the idea was that I saw somewhere on, I don't know, some social media, people posting these posts of this thing called the uncertainty index. Well, there's different uncertainty indexes out there, but some numerical representation of supposedly of uncertainty in the economy. And so there's this chart and it looks like really dramatic. And there's this big spike right now because of all this so-called uncertainty happening around Trump. Now, the thing about an uncertainty index is that, you know, the way this one was built anyways that I was using is largely is measuring like media references and things about, you know, uncertainty or economic political issues or whatever. So you got to wonder about the validity of the data, how well it actually represents true uncertainty in the sense that, like, is it just picking up on media hype or is it really picking up on true levels of uncertainty? Because how do you even quantify something like that in the first place, right? It's uncertainty by its very nature is uncertain. So how can you be so certain about it? You know what I mean? It's a bit of a weird oxymoron thing, right? So anyways, there's this data set that exists that's like that. So, and I think what was striking about it is that like the latest readings of this uncertainty index are so like wildly dramatic. And it, you know, really paints this picture of like, oh my God, you know, what is going on out there right now? This is the worst time in history for uncertainty and yada, yada, yada. So I was like looking at this and I was like, yeah, but does it like really correlate with sales or something like that in our market? So I just ran this pretty simple analysis to look at correlations between sales and this uncertainty index. And it turns out, like from a long-term average sort of perspective, sometimes when the uncertainty index is high, sales are up. Sometimes when it's high, sales are down. Sometimes, you know, so it's up, it's totally random. And these effects essentially cancel each other out over long periods of time. So like the sort of end message of the story is that there's not really any relationship or really good one anyways between this uncertainty index and what's happening in the Greater Vancouver market. Now, but that said, it's a bit hard to like, you know, just push this whole issue aside, right? Like this is pretty uncharted territories for Canada in some ways right now. You know, our neighbor to the south has never really threatened us in this way to this degree. We've certainly had tariff spats before. There's softwood lumber and things like that that, you know, come to mind where we've had disagreements. But there's been trade deals that have been hammered out over the years that like have really benefited both countries. And so this is a bit of an unusual situation. And of course, we also have the political issue right now at the federal level that we now have a looming election. And so there is some actual uncertainty around that that might have some implications for housing, whatever. But that's a bit of a different story. But back to the point around like, you know, is uncertainty the thing keeping people on the sidelines? Perhaps, you know, and anecdotally, when I speak with people operating the market, they're like, yeah, you know, clients are really worried about this and that. But I just kind of doubt it in some ways. Like we just moved and we bought and sold a house and like, I didn't even think twice about tariffs. And maybe I'm a bit weird in that respect or something, but you know, when you look at the reasons that most people actually move, it's not just for the heck of moving. You know, they have life reasons for doing it. They do it because they want to upgrade to a bigger home. Maybe they have children or something like that. Maybe they want to downsize. They have a lot of real reasons for moving. And I don't know how many people are really sitting there on the sidelines fretting about, you know, the impact of tariffs on the market, keeping them from, you know, making an important transaction in their lives that ultimately is aimed at improving their lives. You know, we all have to get on with our lives no matter what's going on in the economy. So, you know, it's a weird one. Like maybe there's something to it. I was actually chatting with Brendan Ogmanson, I think yesterday or something, a bit about this. And he's working it. He saw my piece on that and he was kind of noodling about with some of that data too. And he's got some other interesting analysis that he might come out with in the future on it. But he kind of found a bit of a different tack that does seem like it's making some kind of difference in the market right now. But, you know, it's a bit of a one-time thing. So you get to this argument of like, it's like, is it a this time it's different situation? I don't know. You know, like I just don't buy the story that, you know, Trump sort of threatening tariffs all the way up to basically today, because I think it's April 2nd today, and we've got, I think they've actually implemented some tariffs today, like whereas the implementations have been sort of sporadic and not exactly well thought out, I guess, up until this point. So, you know, we haven't had the real impacts of the full brunt of the tariffs until now. Like if I look at indicators like GDP or, you know, unemployment, whatever, they're not in terrible shape at the moment. And not doing the greatest they've ever been, but it's not like a worrying situation. And so there isn't much of an argument at the moment to say that the tariffs have had a tremendous impact on the economy, which is having the pass-through of an impact onto the housing market, which is the mechanism by which that would operate. I don't know. I'm just kind of at a bit of a loss on that one.
I tend to agree with you that, you know, we work with a lot of end users kind of moving through the market. And the things that nobody who with a newborn or getting a divorce or relocating or whatever stops to say, well, wait, I'm, you know, going to try and time this perfectly, right? They typically, it depends what's going on in their family unit or in their life. And that's what's driving the decision. Where I see it though is like, so well, anecdotally, and I mean, this is from conversations with lots of clients and agents, is I wonder what the correlation is between the uptick of inventory, because you can imagine that a lot of people that have been holding real estate, maybe waiting for a brighter moment in the market, perhaps the tariffs combined with changes to the residential tenancy rules or whatever might trigger, or the threat of the cap gain changes at the federal level might trigger the desire, like the tariffs might be the nail in the coffin, so to speak, on whether or not you're going to sell your Vancouver real estate or your investment properties. So I wonder if it's had an impact on inventory. And then the flip side of that is for buyers that are investors in a moment of uncertainty like this with tariffs, if you were thinking about maybe investing in the real estate market, it just everything layered makes it more challenging and a harder pill to swallow.
Yeah. So you definitely some good points there. And I think like it's important to make that distinction between the kind of investor type of buyer or person in the market as opposed to like the end user. And like my you know, I think the data supports this as well, is that like you can see that investors make up a smaller share of, you know, purchasers and sellers in the market. It's not the bulk of the market. And that's the part that I find, you know, I guess the most compelling to say that I don't know about the tariff issue, right? Like people are generally moving for life reasons. And like somebody who's just, like you said, had a kid or done whatever, they're not going to sit around waiting to time the market perfectly. And, you know, that's the part that I always, it's weird when you like the way that media and stuff pick up on the story about housing. It's always like there's this sort of almost like a presumption in the background of it that everybody who's active in the market is somehow trying to time it. You know what I mean? It's like most people are just getting on with their life, buying and selling, you know, and the world just goes on. When it comes to that investment segment and stuff, yeah, it's entirely possible that there's maybe some people getting a little bit more nervous about, you know, the situation in Canada, but as a result of tariffs. But like, you know, from a longer term perspective, that's one of those like knee-jerk reactions to things. It's sort of like short-term thinking, right? And like you look at like the demographics in Canada and the longer term picture for Canada is still a really bright story. We're not a country that's like going under by any means. You know what I mean? I don't know why there's always so much sour news about Canadian economy and things like that. People just like to make really bad stories because it makes clickable headlines, right? But it's like the reality is we're a country that's sort of chugging along economically. It's sure, it's not the best it's ever been, but we've been through periods like this before. The economy generally picks up, and with technologies like AI and stuff looming on the forefront, yeah, there's the doom side of it, but there's also the potential positive side of it, that there could be huge, huge potential for a country like ours that has a highly educated workforce and a very forward tech sector to, you know, capitalize on these kinds of trends and things like that. We have generally a pretty good demographic structure. There is a bit of an aging population issue, but we've been importing people like through immigration for a really long time. Still have a very strong immigration pipeline of people coming to our country, and they're typically educated and you know, the kind of people that really build the backbone of the economy. And so when you look at it from those lenses, it's like I don't really see the argument of being so, you know, sour on Canada or Vancouver in particular. It's like there's a lot of reasons to be bullish on it, but it's a long-term play. Real estate is not like the stock market. You know, if you're trying to time it like the stock market, you're probably going to get burned because it doesn't operate that way. You know, the timelines are longer and you have to be prepared to park money and park it for a while. I think back to your point though, Adam, there's some aspects of what you were saying around the policy side that I could see of having, you know, some chilling effects on the market, particularly around, you know, the residential tenancy sort of changes, as well around this new flipping tax that the BC government's put out, you know, like that came into effect January. And I was thinking about that this morning. I was doing an interview with a media outlet, and they're asking me sort of about this, and it just sort of popped into my brain halfway through my interview, where this thought kind of jostled in there. I was like, "Oh, what about, you know, those policies that have come into effect?" Because the flipping tax thing came into January, and like, I mean, could it? I don't think it would have a massive effect on the market, but it could be preventing some potential sellers from selling if they bought within, you know, a lot. But I think it's only for people who bought and sold since January, maybe, or something. I don't know. I'd have to check at the fine print of the policy, but there could be reasons at a policy level that people are, you know, hesitating. There's also the whole looming Canadian election thing, which I think, you know, conservative and liberal platforms are kind of trending somewhat in similar directions. Yeah. You know, because they're kind of stealing pages from each other's songbooks or whatever, but like they're, you know, they're not wildly different, but most of it's fairly positive, I think, longer term. There could be a couple impacts that are a bit of shocks to the market, but yeah, maybe it's like policy uncertainty. Like, God, you know, I don't know. I wish I had a better explanation, because it's just not one that I can really see in the data. I haven't been able to pinpoint something where it's like, aha, here's the smoking gun. And that's what I was sort of hoping to find with this uncertainty index, to be honest. When I first started looking into it, I was like, oh, sure. You know, if there really is such a huge relationship between so-called uncertainty in the market and home sales, then it should be really freaking obvious in the data. Like, it should just jump out at you. And it absolutely doesn't. That's the problem. So,
well, Andrew, I'm just to think about this a little bit further, like, and it sounds like there is no, like I was going to say, how do you explain it, right? Because like the narrative, and again, like just thinking of the way we were coming out of 2024 and the optimism, and even January. Like, I think my thinking of how January seemed like a pretty good moment where it's like a continuation, and then it kind of fell off a cliff in February. So is there, I don't think aligning necessarily is like a logical argument that works with the start of the talk of tariffs and things like that. But like, is there any, is there, sounds like there's no other explanation that you've come across that the data supports, at least at this point.
That's right. That's the part that I'm at a loss for. I've been looking to see if I can find in anything, you know, where some sort of marker in the data, some sort of like beacon shining there saying, hey, here's the thing that probably had an impact. And another thing I would say about it actually is like, I was looking, because I was, like I said, I was looking into this issue. So I looked around the world at like home sales in different places. Well, in the US, nationally, their sales are looking a lot like ours right now. And in a lot of the bigger markets, similar patterns and trends. And so like in Canada, the impact of tariffs to us would be a lot more damaging to our economy than Canada slapping tariffs on American products. America, mm-hmm. while we export a lot of goods to the Americans, like it's a hugely important thing for us to export. They're a huge trading partner of ours. For Americans, on the consumption side, it's like maybe, I hope I got these numbers approximately correct. I think it's like 10-15% of like American consumption is like fueled by Canadian exports. So it's not like if we slap things on tariffs on their products, like it's not like they're going to feel it nearly as much on specific items, energy, you know, some things like that. Yeah, we can probably turn up the crank a little bit and give them a bit of heat. But like generally speaking, it's probably not that impactful to the average American. And the reason I raise this is that, okay, if it's not so impactful to Americans and all this hoopla about the tariffs is going around, then why is it that American home sales are doing a pretty similar thing to what we're seeing across Canada? And if I look in somewhere like Australia as well, they also have a similar pattern in home sales at the moment, that things are just gotten a little bit slow to start the year. Now, I don't know. You know, as far as I know, there's no tariffs on Australia, at least from the US at the moment. I haven't double checked that, but like I'm pretty sure there isn't. I haven't heard Trump, you know, going after the Kiwis. The 4 o'clock on the barbecue thing or whatever it is. You know, yeah, like there's no tax on that or whatever, right? So I don't know. You know, like it's weird. And with housing markets, there's an interesting phenomenon that I've noticed in the past 10 years or so looking at the data, is that there seems to be like, I have to do a serious analysis of this at some point, but it feels like to me, in looking at all of this data, just sort of peripherally, feels like there's more synchronicity around housing markets, especially globally important housing markets in the world, than there ever has been. And I feel like part of that is the integration of the global economy. There's like more travel, travel's cheaper, travel's easier. There's been a lot more like immigration over years. There's more people coming from different countries that might have links to other countries. And perhaps through these various linkages, the decision-making process around buying and selling is somehow lining up in a more synchronized way than it ever has. You know, if we go back to the 1940s or something, I would imagine all housing markets sort of beated to their own drum around the world. But when you look at places like Vancouver, or Seattle, New York, LA, whatever, all these kind of bigger centers, there seems to be a correlation between what's going on in one and the other. They tend to move in not exactly lockstep, but pretty close. And so it makes you wonder about the factors influencing it, right? Is it tariffs? Because like I said, in the US, it really isn't impacting them that much from us imposing counter tariffs or anything like that. So how do you explain their market slowing down in these places, mm-hmm. right? It's like, what it points to is perhaps larger global macroeconomic themes, one of which, you know, the most obvious is, of course, interest rates. Maybe they're just not low enough to get people off the sidelines at the moment, you know, or maybe the global uncertainty, people are waiting for lower rates maybe to come out of it. I don't know.
So just quickly, how do we explain the bump in the fall? Or are you even thinking about that? Like, I'm not sure if that was a global phenomenon, but thinking back, like September was slow, right? We remember September was like weirdly slow in 2024, it felt like. And then October, through December and into January felt like there was this groundswell of activity. Like, it's just an interesting, and I'm not saying like, Andrew, explain to me why that happened right now, but it is curious, right? That we seemed like it was like we were obtaining liftoff and then sputtered out to, like, the stats just came out, and we should talk about March. March was 36.8% below the 10-year sales average. Like, that's yeah, dramatic. That makes 2024 look like a busy spring.
Well, it is and it isn't in some ways. So the 10-year average is like this, it's a longer term average. And what we saw in previous years is that sales were hanging around 25-ish% below that number for quite some time. So it's like, it's been that way for a while. What was interesting was at certain points, we saw sales increase to almost in line with 10-year averages, which was like, that was like a wow, that we haven't seen that in ages sort of thing, where that spread between the sales and the 10-year average almost went to zero. So that was really signaling some strength. And yeah, you know, like, how do you explain that bump in the, you know, in that later part of the year? Well, I mean, I think we had like a couple half point reductions, if I recall correctly, mm-hmm. or did we? So like, those were a bit bigger than the quarter point reductions, and maybe those spurred some people off the sidelines. In this presentation I did earlier this year, I toyed around with this kind of concept, a sort of model concept. Like, we've talked before, and like, I can't remember if I've said this on your show or not, but I'm not like a huge, huge fan of like models, like these kind of economic models and things. I think they can be useful in certain contexts, but they sometimes mislead. But so I tend to be sort of, my use of them is sort of judicious, and I try to be pretty careful with what I do with them. But I was sort of toying around with an idea that was like, okay, back to that question around you know, sales being below 10-year averages. It's like, my question was like, well, how long can that go on for, in a sense, right? Because what it's saying, like in a verbal way of communicating the difference between a 10-year average and where sales are at, is like, it's saying that there's some chunk of the market missing, that there's some people who would normally be operating are not operating in the market, right? That's what it's sort of saying. There's a gap. There's an expectational gap around like who normally would be there. And so this question of like who normally would be there is like, then you, that's where I got into this like modeling element of, I was like, well, 10-year averages, sure, you can do it that way. You can say, well, normally we would expect this much with a simple sort of thing based on 10-year average, but you could also do it a different way using a model. So that's what I did. I built a really simple model that just sort of projects like, what would sales hypothetically be like, internalizing factors such as where interest rates are at, what's going on with, you know, unemployment and things. So it's a bit more of a macro focused model, and it has like some, it has some understanding of what's happening in, you know, the broader economic context, as opposed to something like a 10-year average, which is just sort of a naive measure, right? It's just an average over time. There's no, it doesn't know anything about interest rates. Right. It doesn't know anything about whatever, right? Whereas my model has some of that in there. And it turns out you get a fairly close kind of estimate to like what the 10-year average is, but there's some differences in certain places. And then got me thinking about, okay, so let's say I create this hypothetical measure of what demand should be in the market, what sales should be, right? Then I look at where sales are actually at, and I say, okay, well, what's the difference between these two? In some cases, sales are above where it's actually at. Sometimes it's below. In the case where sales are below where the number should be at, it could be interpreted as demand sort of building up on the sidelines. It's a measure of potential dry powder in the market, right? And if you sum it up over time, like every month that goes by where people do not transact in the market who otherwise probably would based on this model, if you believe models or whatever, that tends to build up. The pressure builds up, and it builds up and builds up and builds up until there's a trigger event where some of that pressure gets released, right? So if you have a trigger event like rates coming down like a full percentage point or something pretty quickly over the short span of a few months, maybe that's enough to get some of that demand off the sidelines, maybe not all of it, right? So the question now becomes like, well, it seems like there's actually a buildup of some pent-up demand on the sidelines from transactions not being as strong as they should be. And the question now in my mind is like, where's the trigger event that's going to bring those people off the sidelines? Do we have to wait till all this nonsense with the US is over with or something? Or do we have to wait till after the election? Or do we have to see rates, you know, go down another quarter point? Or what is it, right? But I do think if you believe models, and I only kind of half believe this one because I'm all skeptical of them. But I do think there's maybe some reasonable argument there to be made that there is some people waiting to transact, and that pool of people waiting who really do want to make a trade, but they're just hesitating for whatever reason. I feel like that pool of people is building up. And once you get a moment where there's a trigger event, like we may see sales snap back in a really big way.
Is shifting gears a little bit from buyers to sellers, because it's interesting, like, you know, often I feel like people talk about, you know, if you're buying the uncertainty kind of argument, it's like paralysis, right? It's just like there's no oil in the engine, like it just grinds to a halt type thing. But that's not the case with people looking to list their properties. Can we talk a little bit about what's going on with listings and what your thoughts are there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a really interesting point, right? It's like, where are the buyers? Because the sellers are there, right? And so that's another, to me, I guess it weakens the argument around the uncertainty hesitation thing, right? It's like, well, if sellers are willing to participate, why aren't buyers, right? It's like sellers are obviously not really, like, people have to sell for various reasons, but not everybody has to sell. You know, I'm sure you guys know from working with clients for many years that, like, oftentimes people move for life reasons or they make changes, but they're not usually in a desperate situation to make a transaction. It's not like, you know, there's a gun to their head saying, like, well, you got to do this month or that's it. Like, that's not really the situation for most people. So it is a bit of a puzzle. Why are sellers so eager, you know, and willing to make trades? And buyers are not there. I don't know, you know, but it certainly, to me, it weakens the argument that, like, uncertainty from tariffs have something to do with it, like, at least for the seller side of it. Like, maybe buyers are hesitating because of that, but it seems like it's just, pardon the phrasing, but it just feels like a weak argument to me. Like, it really does. Mm-hmm. It's just like every time I turn around, you can always kind of find like a hole in it, like in the story where it's sort of like, that doesn't really add up. It's a convenient thing to just point to because it's so like front and center in media and everything right now. But it's just like there's activity happening in the market and we're still seeing sales. It's not like sales are frozen. It's not like there's zero. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You're still seeing people transact. It's just that pool of, you know, buyers who maybe are a little bit more like fair weather buyers or something like that, right? Where they prefer to look for the best opportunity, or maybe they have the luxury of waiting. You know, maybe it's that. So, but yeah, indeed, on the listing side, you know, things are up, and that's with the slower sales. That's what's led to the big inventory growth, right? But as I was saying on the media call this morning, it's like, you know, where inventory is at right now, in my opinion, is a healthy level of inventory. It's nice to actually see inventory somewhere around, you know, 15,000 or something. Like it should be around there most of the time, so that people have choice and we don't get these like explosive growth in price. If demand comes in, and that's usually what triggers, you know, policy responses, which Lord knows we don't really need any more of those hitting our market. So, you know, it's good to have a choice and so on. So,
yeah. Huh.
I just want to follow up quickly on that because, you know, 15,000, around 15,000 is healthy. Definitely not going to see any kind of explosive demand shock where prices at least immediately start rising. What about declines? Because we've seen a couple percentage points over the last year in most areas. What does this look like if the buyers just continue to not show up here? What's your best guess on potential declines?
Yeah, incredibly, you know, it's Vancouver or the greater Vancouver region as well as like it's surprisingly resilient on price. And, you know, again, this could be a factor explaining, you know, some of the slower sales as well. It's like it could be that there's a lot of buyers who were expecting bigger price declines, but sellers in our region, like I said, if they're not desperate to sell, they don't have to. And so they can wait, they can hold their prices. And, you know, usually the reason inventory grows is because of some gap between sales and listings. And like, why does the gap occur? Well, the primary reason is a kind of disagreement between buyers and sellers on price. Right? I mean, if the prices were lower by 10-15%, we'd have a booming market probably. And like, right, the homes would be clearing like off the shelves like really quickly. We'd have no inventory, you know? But the trouble is that people buy and they expect a certain price for their house. And if they're comfortable and they don't have to sell, they'll wait it out. You know, they'll wait for better times until they can get their price. So that's one aspect of that. And, you know, it's true that prices have come down a little bit over the past year or two. Right now, actually, depending on the measure you look at, some HPI measures are looking like they're ticking back up very slightly. This is not tremendous price growth, but maybe like 0.5%, 1% here and there. So the attached segment is one that I'd be keeping an eye on for price growth. It's as much inventory as there is on the market. The one trouble with the attached segment for like Metro Vancouver is that we just don't have a lot of that product type built. So that leads to there just not being a lot of that product type available in the market, period. And there's only about, I think, 2,200 active listings or something for attached dwellings right now in GVR's market areas. And like when you think about how few properties that is for how many people out there might be looking for that kind of property, so that's not a lot. So there's a lot of demand for that, but not a lot of inventory in that particular segment. But other segments, there's a lot more choice and you know, people, especially like detached and stuff, with the price point being what it is, you know, I think people are being a lot more picky and choosy in that segment. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I in our forecast, we actually called for a little bit higher price growth in the attached segment. One of the other factors behind that was that there was this change to the cap on insured mortgages, like I think it was late last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that allows people to purchase up to $1.5 million with insured mortgages. And that, I think, is a really nice change because my suspicion, I wrote a piece on this a long time ago called The $1 Million Wall, where it kind of got into this whole notion of like, hey, once you hit the $1 million mark, you suddenly have to cough up $200,000 for a down payment or more, right? As per regulation. Now they've made that cap at $1.5 million, allowing people to put a lower down payment. And so my theory was that there's a lot of people probably trapped up against that wall who actually can afford the payments on a home that's a little bit over $1 million, but who couldn't scrounge together the $200,000 down payment. And so I feel like that might be one of the changes that's actually positively impacting the market in terms of adding some, you know, housing mobility from people through the system, and also keeping the attached segment a little bit more active. I think that might be a change that is influencing that at the moment.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Event Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
We've talked about it a lot on our show, and it does seem like there is something that has almost changed in Vancouver, where we used to be a market that would, you know, occasionally have soft spots, but generally a lot of buyer demand, big run-ups on pricing, multiple offers everywhere. And I feel for like the past few years, obviously the interest rate has had a large impact, but we've seen rates starting to come down. But there does seem to be a different sentiment. You know, something has almost changed in the air in Vancouver in the last few years where it doesn't feel maybe like the same market as yesteryear. I don't know if I'll leave this open for comments to both of you maybe, but what's everyone's thought on like just what has changed in the city, or am I missing something?
I don't think you're off base at all. There's the way I've been looking at it over the past, I don't know, 10 or more years, looking at this market and kind of looking at the data, how it's shifted over time. One of the big changes that we have right now, well, there's a couple. So I'll start with like one is that the inventory situation is like, if you look back in 2016, almost 10 years ago, believe it or not, you know, inventory was a lot lower. We had a situation where we kind of had a really low levels of inventory, and that's what was driving the price growth, right? Like that's how things got so hysterical, right? Like that's where people would show up to an open house. There'd be 100 other people there. The property would go for multiple offers, and it's because there was nothing else for sale. And so that drove these headlines that were like, you know, prices are up like enormous month over month or year over year, and there's no supply. And it's like, and that's what triggered, you know, like I said, this is what you don't want, is you don't want the finger of government coming into the housing space because of stories like this, where, oh, suddenly, okay, well, government comes in. Oh, what was it? Oh, it's foreign buyers. So they slapped the foreign buyer tax, right? And I put a chill through the air. People are, oh God, it is for foreign buyers or something. And then, you know, that tax gets implemented and there was a short-term like lull in the market, but then it was back off to the races because it turned out that foreign buyers weren't exactly the primary driver of the market, right? And so we go through these cycles like that. And then, you know, more recently, we've had like the NDP government since 2016, and they've implemented, you know, just an enormous amount of housing-focused policy. And more recently, we've just had a battery of it unleashed on the market. And maybe, you know, people are starting to feel a bit of policy fatigue. It's like, they're just sick of, you know, every time they turn around and they want to make a transaction or something, oh, the government's got a new rule. Like one of the ones that really bugs me right now is the flipping tax. Like, because I think they're really targeting, they're trying to kill an ant with a steamroller kind of thing. And it's, you know, like the part that really irks me about a policy like that is that it reduces mobility in the housing market for people who just want to make a normal move. Now, I know the policy has all kinds of exemptions, but it's weird to now have to justify why you are moving to the government if you are moving within the span of 730 days or whatever. You have to now tell the government why you're moving, and the government has to agree that the reason you're moving is one of the reasons that they deem as being valid for moving, such that you don't incur some sort of tax for being a so-called speculator or a flipper, right? Ridiculous, in my opinion, but this is where we're at. You know, this is where we're at with policy, and this is what happens when you end up in a market that has way too little inventory and like price escalation, like the way it was. You get, you know, the finger of policy finding its way into the market because people start demanding it. Then, you know, now fast forward to today, we've got way more inventory on the market, not necessarily as a result of policy changes, primarily as a result of interest rate changes that we just had a huge, huge run up in rates. And that really put the damper on sales. Like I talked about earlier, sales have been trending like 25% below 10-year averages for ages now. You know, it feels like an eon. And that's what allowed inventory to accumulate. And so now there is a very different feeling in the air. We have one of like massive overregulation from government at almost every single angle that you look at. Housing is trying to be strangled into some level of affordability from some policy somewhere. Then you also have this fact that there's a lot more inventory on the market, which from a headline standpoint is wildly unusual for the market here. So people aren't really talking about it in the same ways that they used to, where it was like, oh, you know, everybody knew somebody who just, you know, sold a house at multiple offers and got some great deal on it or something, right? Now you're not really hearing much about it and things have just gotten quieter. And to a degree, it's a bit of a welcome change. You know, I think it's not necessarily bad that we have a market that's a little bit quieter, but it certainly has change the feeling in the air around Vancouver real estate, I would say.
There's nothing, you know, just two points, and both these are not, you know, super enlightened points or anything like that. But when I think back to like 2015, 2016, you know, we'd be like working with people that would be buying like a P pied-à-terre or at Yaletown Park, you know, and it's like, oh, we, on the weekends, we go downtown and we'll go see a show or whatever. And, you know, and then we'll go back to Coquitlam or wherever they live and things like that. And there was like a level of like glamour and sexiness to that kind of thinking that I feel like there's nothing sexy about filling out the BC speculation tax forms that everybody just went through. Like it's like deadening and annoying. And 3/4 of the people I talk to forget to do it. And it's like tedious, right? So I feel like that point about overregulation is definitely one. There's nothing sexy about it right now. And then, but the second one is like, and this goes back to a point, Adam, I think you made last year. And I feel like it was back when Todd Talbot was on the show and we kind of asked him, oh, what's an exciting area or what are you excited about right now? Or where would you ask your niece to, or tell your niece to invest? And his point was like, nobody wants to talk about that stuff. Like, come on, that's, and it's like, well, wait, 2 years ago, he would have had 10 ideas. It's like the culture is also shifted around. Like it's something you wouldn't want to bring up at a party that you made money in real estate somehow. Like there's been a kind of cultural shift that's hard to explain. But yeah, I guess both those things. It just feels like a, you know, I'm just saying the same thing both you said, a very different moment in Vancouver.
Yeah, I'd agree. And, you know, actually, I was going to revisit this. I got to check on the data in a bit. This is a real slow moving data set. It's demographics. So last I looked into it was a couple of years ago. And at the time, there's sort of this bulge of the millennial generation entering the home buyer years. And there still are, but we're sort of at like the number of millennials entering into the home buying years at the sort of early cutoff around 20-ish years old, that cohort of people is getting smaller and smaller and smaller every year because the bulge, the bulk of the bulge has sort of moved through the well into the home buying years, I should say. And they're actually starting to move almost to the chunk of being out of the home buying years, like the primary home buying years anyways. And so there could be a bit of a demographic thing behind it as well, but it's a slow mover of a change that you wouldn't really, you know, you wouldn't just wake up one day and say, aha, this is dramatically changed. It's something that's like a drip that happens very, very slowly. It's like more like erosion. But I do think there might be something to that where there was a sort of peak time with a huge amount of millennial people trying to get into the market all around the same time. And, you know, prices were moving really quickly and we had really, really low inventory. And there was just this outcry from a younger generation saying, why the hell is this so hard for me? You know, my parents didn't have it this hard, blah, blah, blah. And this is, again, partly what led to a lot of these policy changes and I think part of the support for parties like the NDP, part of their base was a younger generation who was frustrated. In a way, there's a funny predictability around this is that, I don't know if this is true for you guys, it is for me, but the older you get, the more conservative you lean. And I'm not saying I'm like a diehard blue conservative guy here or something like that. I'm just saying that when I was 15, I viewed the world through, you know, much more kind of liberal lenses of things that like there are a lot more of like rights and wrongs and there ought to be this thing or ought to be that. The older I get, the less I'm like that. And I feel like as, you know, that millennial generation enters into the home buying years and they've purchased their homes and they eventually, because many people eventually get into the market. Yes, it's a huge struggle. Yes, it's very difficult. But the reality and the data it shows this is that eventually, well, almost everybody finds, you know, a home to call their own eventually. It's a struggle, but that's the nature of the beast. And when they do, these issues stop mattering as much to them around, you know, the foreign buyers or whatever it might be and clamoring for various policy changes. Suddenly these things become slightly less important because they have theirs, you know what I mean? And now they have other priorities. They have children or whatever to look after. They're not struggling to get on that first rung of the housing ladder so much anymore as they're trying to move up. And so, you know, some of those topics that may have been really front and center, even 10 years ago, they might be drifting off into a less relevant space in the media and so on, largely driven by demographic changes. That it's just the people who care about it are getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah. And I think it's funny. When I first, 15 years ago, when I first got into real estate, I felt like there was a real excitement in the city and the future of the city. And I also felt like there was almost like a gold rush mentality or excitement around the city. And I feel like now it's the shine has faded a bit, and it's because of affordability and policy or whatever you want to say. But there's a lot of people that are more skeptical about future gains in the market. And also the flip side of that is I think there's a lot of people that, one thing we haven't talked about, but, and I wonder if you have any data this, but people leaving the Lower Mainland, because one thing you are hearing more about now is, you know, excitement around everything from, you know, Calgary to Victoria to wherever, right? Where you're seeing a lot of people move for affordability and some, you know, highly desirable cities that that you could, one could argue, have a brighter future than they might have a decade ago, right? It's something with more shine on them.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some data on this that we can look at, particularly, you know, you have measures of migration that we can look at, and there's every year there obviously is some level of people that leave the province for elsewhere. But the reality is the number of people coming into our province absolutely dwarfs that number by a tremendous amount every year. Like, we have way more people coming in from out of country typically to British Columbia than we have people leaving for other provinces. So like on net, you know, most of our growth is actually occurring through the immigration channel. And so, yes, we definitely have some folks who are maybe like, you know, grew up in the Lower Mainland or something, are heading for greener pastures elsewhere that are more affordable. But we also have a tremendous amount of people coming in who are finding Vancouver still to be a very appealing place to live, despite the affordability aspects of it, right? It's always a weird one to me, you know, like it is an expensive market. But like, you think about like, the way I kind of look at this is like, we're no longer in a world where housing markets are so isolated into like being just the only, you know, you move to the big city that's the closest one to wherever you grew up, right? Like, now people have choices. They can move to wherever they want to. There's digital nomads these days. They don't even have a fixed address. You know, they just roam the world with a laptop and work. Like, people got choices like galore that they didn't have before. And we're just in a really different era where people have a lot more ability to pick and choose where they want to go. And it always surprises me how many people continue wanting to come to places like Vancouver or other very high price markets, even in spite of the fact that prices are high. It's really surprising. So, you know, I wouldn't paint Vancouver's future as being like one that's like less bright than something like, you know, Calgary or whatever. You know, even in some of those, like I sort of cut my teeth on market analysis way back in the day with CMHC starting out Calgary long ago, and we used to look at that market. And you know, markets like that, they may seem rosy at certain points in time, but that one's really tied to energy. And so when the energy markets go down, you know, that market goes down pretty hard. When we look at something like Vancouver, we have a much more well-rounded like economy. We don't tend to have the wild gyrations that you get from, you know, markets with sort of singular, almost singular drivers of growth. You know what I mean? So we're a really fortunate region with lots of beautiful places. You mentioned Victoria and some other, you know, there's just lots of great places people could live around the province. Like, we're seeing a lot more action in places like Squamish. And you know, it's, I don't actually view this sort of movement of people outside of the major centers to smaller centers as a negative. I think it's actually a really great thing where we're breathing new life into some of these communities and you know, people are building lives in places that are some of the most beautiful regions in our province. It's great that people are getting out there and accessing that more, I would say.
Andrew, you mentioned earlier that I think it was in your introduction that you love watching, or you're really interested in watching kind of macro trends. I'm just wondering, for the rest of 2025, are there certain economic indicators you think our listeners should be watching? Like, what do you put another way? You know, you mentioned there's going to be this, you know, one thing that occurs where it's potentially sparks demand to swarm back into the market. Best guess on what that could be. What should people be watching?
Oh yeah. Well, the one indicator, if I think the way that I feel about it at the moment, given what's going on in the world, is sort of like, I feel like rates would be the indicator that would, you know, if we for some reason got, you know, a bigger decline in rates, you know, that could be a trigger bringing people off the sidelines in a big way. Now, how could that happen? Well, one unfortunate option is that, you know, Canada tips into a recession as a result of tariffs. So the other kind of indicators people could watch for, you know, one that I'm watching pretty closely in BC and Canada is like the unemployment rate, what's going on there, particularly in what industries that are being most impacted. You know, it'll be interesting to see how tariffs shake out, how long they last, whether they're just being used as a bargaining tool or if there's something a little bit more permanent. You know, that's really going to be the question mark for Canada this year, like, and that also for BC and the Lower Mainland. Now, when I look recently, you know, like our unemployment rate is not worryingly high at the moment in the region, and it doesn't seem to be ticking up enormously. The problem with those indicators, however, is they're lagging. We get the data, you know, a little bit late. Like it's a survey of employment. So by the time, you know, there's actually job losses and stuff in the economy, we're a couple months behind the ball in seeing it, you know. So, but that said, you know, those are the kinds of things, the big macro things I'm going to be watching for to see if these tariffs really have relevance, right? Like going back to the earlier part of the conversation, you know, I'm skeptical of the argument around tariffs from a psychological aspect, but I'm also somewhat skeptical of it from the aspect of real impacts on the ground to the economy. I totally understand and believe that there are real impacts. However, you know, Canada's not stupid. We're not a country full of dumb people who are just going to roll over and let Americans, you know, plow us with tariffs and we're just going to do nothing about it. I mean, we are obviously going to start looking for new trading partners and look for like new opportunities. And, you know, we've always found a way as a country. And I'm optimistic that Canada will find its way out of it. So, you know, while there's a lot of really, you know, dour scenarios modeling out the impact of something like tariffs and in Canada, I think the reality might be a little more blunted in that, like, I don't know that the impact will be as strong if we as a country are able to pivot and find new trading routes, new trading partners and outlets for our businesses, which honestly, in the long run, that will make our country a heck of a lot stronger and a lot more resilient to future shocks like this. It's actually probably good for the economy in a long-term perspective. It's terrible over the short run to have it come about this way. What an awful, you know, way to spur our economy into pivoting into, you know, perhaps more fruitful trading relationships. But I guess this is the way that you know, the U.S. administration wants to play it, and it's the cards that were dealt. So we got to, you know, play that hand. And so yeah, I'll, you know, like I said, I'll be watching the unemployment rates and stuff fairly closely in Canada this year. What the Bank of Canada chooses to do, it's gonna be a really interesting one. Inflation, of course, is another one that's actually had a bit of an uptick recently, which has got me a little bit worried. I was like, that shouldn't be going in that direction right now. But there's some reasons behind it I want to get into. It's all super technical, but I think it's more of a blip that'll subside soon. But you know, there are some potential dangers of inflationary effects from these tariffs and so on, and that's a worry as well. Like rates could go up to counteract that, right? So where we go, holy moly, I don't know. You know, this is a real doozy in trying to figure this one out, because, you know, the Bank of Canada is really caught in a very difficult situation between balancing, you know, their mandate for low inflation and the growth and having growth in the economy, and how they stick handle this puck that the Americans have tossed us is going to be a really interesting one to watch over the course of 2025.
Well, maybe that's a great place to leave it, Andrew. But we do have this segment called the 5-Wire, 5 lighthearted questions to end the show. Do you have time to stick around for that? I think they've changed since we last on.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the presale world on fire without a spark.
All right. First question, Andrew. What's a restaurant in Metro Vancouver that you think more people should know about? Or Victoria?
Or the island, yeah.
Honestly, I would say, actually, so it's in Metro Vancouver. I grew up in it. Well, so, okay. First of all, this is not some, like, this isn't in a restaurant that you're going to go, like, take a date out to as a fancy sort of, this is not like, that
where
kind
this
of,
is going.
So, okay. So when I grew up like in the South Surrey White Rock area, and there on the strip in White Rock, there's a little restaurant called Moby Dick, and it's a seafood place. And it's sort of famous because it's been around since around 1970s or something. And of course, as a kid, I used to go there with my parents, and there's a nostalgic element to it, but it's full of like kind of fisherman kitsch and things like that inside. And it's kind of, it's just like an interesting little spot. And one of the things I like about their fish is, first of all, it's good. It's if you like fish and chips, you like real greasy sort of things, like the portion sizes are enormous, at least as far as I remember. I haven't been there in a few years, but yeah, real big portion sizes. And like, you know, it's just a nice experience to go down, get some fish and chips. You grab it and you go sit on the seaside and, you know, watch the waves roll in, try to keep the seagulls from eating your fries or whatever. It's a, I don't know. It's a nice experience. It's a great way to spend a sunny afternoon.
That's a good one. Love it. One book you would recommend?
Well, we like haven't really been reading too much in the past little while.
Yeah,
but
you're the technical manuals guy.
Yeah, yeah.
We should have changed this.
I did actually read a book, but it was more of like a, I don't know if it's in the category you would put it in. It's like in the, you know, one of those kind of business books or whatever. That's like, hey, how to improve your career sort of thing or something like that. Anyways. And it was called Rework. The idea is like generally behind it was like, it's really about thinking about, you know, where this is more applicable to people in sort of corporate settings, first of all. So, you know, maybe a lot of your listeners who are in the business of real estate and stuff as agents and so on may not find this as insightful. But for those of us stuck in working stiff jobs or whatever, where we got to go to the office or these days work from home or whatever, the book's a lot about like, getting rid of clutter in the corporate context. So things like meetings that you don't need to have, stop having them, you know, stop with the endless meetings and like trying to find ways to make your work life a lot more efficient in terms of like measuring actual outputs and things as opposed to various like, you know, make work projects that people always make up for themselves. Like, I don't know if you guys have had experience in the corporate sector or whatever, but like there's a high correlation between the length of time someone spends in a corporate job and the amount of kind of busy work they create for themselves over time. So this is all about kind of reducing that and getting back to your core function about like, what is it that you actually do in your job and do it well, focus on the outputs that matter, cut all the clutter, get rid of all the pointless meetings and just sort of get on with it. And it was a kind of eye-opening book that way for me. Not that I find myself in too many meetings per se, but it was refreshing to have a perspective that I really agree with from that. Whereas a lot of, you know, other books would say, well, you know, you got to set up a big corporate structure and a whole thing to get yourself to the top of the chain or whatever. It's a very like takes a orthogonal kind of angle from those kinds of books. So it was interesting from that perspective.
Question number three, Andrew, what's an opinion that you held about Vancouver real estate that has maybe changed over your current role as a director of economics and data analytics at Greater Vancouver Realtors?
I guess this goes back a little bit even before I joined the board, because I was working in policy for the government before. And I think this is where things actually really shifted for me. I was working in housing policy specifically. And it was an eye-opener in that, like, when I joined the government, I was, I don't know, almost 10 years younger or something. And I guess, like I was saying earlier, you're like when you're younger, you have a lot of people anyways, tend to have a lot more liberal ideas about the world or whatever. And as you get older, some of those ideas start falling by the wayside because you see how the world really works. And I think one of the conclusions I've come through to that was a sort of difficult one to swallow is that like, I don't really believe as much in technocratic solutions to our biggest like policy issues anymore. And what I mean by that is there are, you know, I'm not trying to necessarily pick on the NDP or something particularly here, but it is a government that very much has taken the technocratic approach to solving, say, things like housing policy, right? They say, well, we've got data on this and therefore we shall do that. I worked in that sausage shop and I saw the data and it was questionable whether they really had the data to, you know, justify the various policies that they have. And so upon seeing all of this and realizing, as I said, how the world really works and how you see how ideology starts finding its way into so-called technocratic solutions, you know, I have a harder time swallowing a technocratic solution being proposed by somebody because I really think that behind it is some sort of ideology-driven sort of narrative. And while the alternative, which is generally that we would have, you know, a democratic sort of way of deciding what we as a population should do, while that doesn't always result in the best results for everybody, I think at least at the end of the day, being able to say that we as a democracy agreed upon some direction and went that way, as opposed to having even if it doesn't end up serving us well, you know, well, then it's our own fault, right? I feel like that's a better way in some senses of managing the world and you know, the economy and things like that sometimes than it is to have a purely technocratic solution that says like, thou shalt do this because the data says that. That's a worrying direction to go down because eventually it stops serving a lot of people. And I worry that to a degree, Vancouver, we talked a bit about how there's that change in the air. There's so much regulation now around housing. It's made it a very much a no fun place to buy real estate or to operate, which is exactly the intention of the government. That was precisely what they wanted. You can't have a short-term rental. You can't have a second property. You can't keep a home vacant. You can't do this. You can't do that. And they've got exactly what they wanted. Unfortunately, they still don't have affordability. And so, you know, this is what I mean.
Well, now they're starting to pivot, right? Now they're starting to pivot back to trying to welcome investors back into the market, which is like an insane about face.
And so that's what I mean. It's just with technocratic solutions, that's where they can sort of end up sometimes. It's too bad, but that's a realization. It was a hard one for me to swallow. It took a while to kind of come around to that conclusion. But now I think, you know, the will of the people is probably a better route.
This question should have came first at the beginning of the show. That's gold.
Oh, yeah. Next one. What have you been binge watching lately?
Yeah.
we had a child recently. So it's the first one for us. And so like, not necessarily like watching a heck of a lot. I've been watching my child a lot is one thing I've been doing. Like learning all these like noises and stuff that newborns make are all kind of unnerving and things.
Breathing.
But there's also, you know, there's endless amounts of like YouTube stuff about how to do this with your baby or whatever, this and that. You know, it gets to a point of being somewhat concerning because it's like, I'm not really sure if I'm following smart advice or just crazy people on YouTube anymore, but you get desperate at a certain point when your baby's crying all night or something, right? So, you know, you do what you have to do.
Well, that beats Miss Rachel. So you got a lot to look forward to. Question number five, something that you've purchased for under $1,500 that has had a positive impact on your life recently.
I'm trying to think of it. Like, cause well, we just bought a house and that was way over $1,500, unfortunately, but that's definitely had a huge, huge impact on my life. What have I bought? You know what? Honestly, I'm struggling to think
we'll
of something.
House. We'll take
yeah, house. Yeah. You know, like because of the house purchase and everything, like we really haven't been spending, you know, money on other things at the moment. Well, here's one. Like in the house we were renovating, I bought some paint for the new house. Made a huge difference in this because the place was so dark. Somebody had a real dark color scheme in here. Put some white paint on the wall. Oh man, it's like being in some Zen garden or something after being in a dungeon. It's wonderful. It's lovely. So a couple $100 on paint. There you go.
That's
fantastic.
A great one.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thanks again, Andrew, for again, taking the time to talk to us. That was a great conversation. And for people who are looking to follow along, you mentioned a website earlier on. Where should people follow you?
Yeah, definitely. Head on over to economics.gvrealtors.ca and you'll find all the stuff that I'm putting out there through on the kind of economic side of things and even some of the kind of data products and things that we're working on, especially those that are available for public consumption. So yeah, that's probably the best way to follow. And if you want to email me or something, the email address is alis@gvrealtors.ca.
Well, thanks again for taking the time today, Andrew.
You're very welcome. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Andrew Liss, Director, Economics and Data Analytics over at Greater Vancouver Realtors. And as always, Adam, fantastic conversation with Andrew.
Yeah, no, always great having Andrew on the program.
What a doozy of a quarter.
No kidding. No kidding. But I mean, you know what? What's the most, what they're saying right now, the most recent objection is the election. And we just got off of, we're in a trade war, you know, it's a lot of reasons.
We should say too, we recorded this, before what is, we're recording this on Tuesday. So Wednesday, I think is what are they calling it in Freedom Day or Independence Day, or tomorrow is the day they drop all the retaliatory tariffs. So yeah, we're recording this before all the big news out of the U.S. But yeah, we're looking backwards in the last quarter in that conversation and with a little forecasting as well. But anyway, great conversation with Andrew as always.
Yeah. And I'm starting to think I might have been too fired up about that secret car, Matt. And I'm not a brand guy, but that was my first time driving a Mercedes. And I wore my Versace. So here's the thing about having... When you're not really, it's exciting when you don't treat yourself. So what else do we got before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? Well, you can treat yourself over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer where we're sending out stats, both Greater Vancouver Realtor stats, but also different types of stats where you can really dig into neighborhoods and price bands. We're sending out VIP access to pre-sales related to skytraincondo.ca, which is our other site that we sometimes mention on the show, VIP access to pre-sales, deal of the month. There's all sorts of reasons why you should be on the LiveWire. We also have, of course, Adam, tried and true private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click buy with us. This is the best way, the best listing software and the best way to monitor the market. So just head over, sign up for your own free account and monitor the market on us.
Absolutely. I'm just thinking here, Adam, your comment about Mercedes reminded me of Tom Garvey, the old...
old managing broker, yeah.
Years ago. He used to call Mercedes a Merc. I think he was the only
Merc. I've heard the Merc comment too.
Oh yeah.
See when I okay. see this is not no, that we're trying to.
He'd say
not that we're trying to talk no, about social classes, but when I hear Merc, I immediately think Mercury. I bought a Mercury.
Mercury the car. Okay.
That'll tell you about my growing up, the types of cars we were driving. Yeah, Merc was never. Yeah, of course, a Mercury. Well, if you want to talk about fantastic cars, well, or anything else, better call you than me. But how can people get in touch?
They can get in touch at any time by calling 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, have a great week. And we are back here next week with another great episode. Can't wait.
That is absolutely true.
Some,
we'll see you next
and
week.
Some absolute bangers coming soon.
Yeah.
So,
we've lined them up and now we're just going to knock them down.
2000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.